This is the second session of the interview with Charles Center. It's now the 21st of December. Yes. You were on the Kiekhoffer Teaching Award Committee.
Yes, the Kiekhoffer Teaching Award Committee. This special committee on university integration in 1955. And what was the other one you described?
I've forgotten what the name of it is.
Student Ethics or whatever.
Committee on Student Personnel with Fred Haberman, Aaron Ide,
well,
Jay Ritchie, Louise Troxell, and
we can dispose of all three of them very
reasonably
quickly, in that I have no particular specific memories of the activities of any of these committees.
Hmm.
I'm sure I attended their meetings. I'm sure I put in my nickel's worth, but I don't have any particular memory of any of them.
So nothing earth-shaking? Or
Even less than that. Not that much.
Hmm. Well, it was quite a while ago.
Well, it's 32 years we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I've also mentioned to you President Fred's committee, a special committee which, is, as far as I know, was more or less ad hoc at his pleasure of somewhere perhaps 15, 18 members of the faculty. This was not his executive committee, which consisted of deans and other officers of the university. He would bring this faculty committee into his office in Bascom Hall about once a month to react, to respond to anything he cared to bring up. And again, I have, at this late date, no particular memory of anything that we may have talked about. But I was asked to serve on that and did for as long as it existed. Two, 3 years, I suppose.
And you said that if you were sitting more than a few people down the table.
Should I answer that?
Yes.
Well, after last session, I feel very guilty about things that I said then, and I hope they don't go anywhere. Well, it was just that President Fred was a fine gentleman, but he had a way of speaking, a rather very low tone of voice, as if he were addressing his remarks to his necktie, down his chest, as it were. And my hearing never being too great, if I was seated very far away from him or along that big table, I never knew what he was talking about. So I'm afraid that my contributions and participation weren't very much.
That's interesting. I've never heard about that committee. I mean, there's been a great deal of, you know, people have talked about Fred in many
respects. Well, as I say, I don't know that the committee was in any formal structure.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was an ad hoc affair that he wanted to be able to sit down and visit with a group of faculty people.
Do you have any memory of any of the other people on the committee? Even a few names?
No, not now. I couldn't.
Hmm.
Sorry.
Right.
As I say, I'm struggling to remember anything we talked about or that he presented without any success in remembering. Sorry.
All right. My next question has to do with some correspondence I found in the files in 1967 when Robin Fleming was just coming in the summer, coming to the end of his chancellorship. And he had two talks with Dean Gomnitz, confidential talks. Apparently there was a great deal of dissatisfaction in the business school. And I would like to, and they were discussing the possibility that there should be an evaluation of the school. Would you, talk about what your sense of the school
yes,
was at the time?
I recall that. I recall that. The faculty welcomed Irv Gomnitz taking over as dean following Fay Elwell with open arms. We all loved the man. I think I knew him as well personally as anyone, because I'd, going back to 1939-40, I'd been his teaching assistant. And we had shared an office for one or perhaps 2 years on the fourth floor of Sterling Hall. And we were, with Evelyn Gomlitz and my wife Libby, we were good social friends, and square dance partners and all that kind of picnics and so on. Well, in the 10 or 12 years possibly between Irv's beginning as dean and the period you are talking about, the love affair ended. Simply because, in the view of the faculty, rightly or wrongly, Irv had too much difficulty making any decisions. He was never a man who would willingly say no to anyone. You could go in, as I recall on some occasions, to his office to talk about some things, things I thought could be done, needed to be done, might be done. And we would sit there and visit with, or some whatever period. He would talk at length. He would never say no, but he would never say yes. And I'd walk out thinking, well, what now? I don't know any more about what the dean thinks than I did before. Well, I sort of knew, knowing Irv, that his way of saying no was to avoid saying anything. To talk at length, but not to say either yes or no. Mm-hmm. If you got a little encouragement out of it, you could probably take it to mean yes. Well, of course, there had been a good many changes in the development of the university in that same period of time, as in the School of Business. And the faculty were quite restive under Irv, simply because it felt that there wasn't enough leadership from the dean's office. Another minor point of irritation was that in faculty meetings, the dean would talk at great length. When we were all done, people would say, well, what did we talk about? What did we do? Without being able to put their fingers on anything concrete in the way of results of a faculty meeting. Why do you ask me this, get me into this? Am I involved in that correspondence with Robin Fleming?
No, it's just clearly an important period in the business school.
Possibly, and I don't remember. I knew Robin Fleming personally, outside of our relationships officially. It's possible that he talked with me, called me to visit about whatever, to get a reaction from within the faculty, someone he knew, having known that there were rumblings of dissatisfaction. Can you get it, please, Mary? In the school. Mm-hmm. I don't recall that was the case, but it may have been. And also, about that time, the faculty said, we've got to do something. We love Irv, we want to keep him, but we've got to reform him, change him. And the big question was, who is going to bell the cat? So I was the lucky individual selected by the faculty to go and have a frank talk with Irv to give him some of the feelings of dissatisfaction in the faculty, which he may have been completely unaware, and to see if he couldn't do some things that would change the atmosphere for the better. I did. Our one result, of course, was that our faculty meetings, the nature of the agenda changed. They did become more definite and more specific. Mm. And I said, Irv, you got to learn to curb your tongue, not to talk at great length. If you want to do that, then you better talk to a specific point and come to a conclusion instead of meandering all over, getting nowhere. Well, there was a little improvement in that direction. But it's very difficult for any of us to change our natures. Mm. And it just, even though he may have wanted to and tried to, he couldn't really change himself very much. Well, that's about the story.
How did he take your suggestions?
Well, I say there was a noticeable change in the conduct and the content of faculty meetings thereafter.
But I mean, when you actually talked to him, was he? He didn't mind. Was he glad that you had talked to him?
I never knew. That was obviously a very great risk in belling the cat for me. Mm. After all, he was my administrative officer. I'm a department chairman, a professor reporting to the dean. It certainly didn't help me any, put it that way.
So he didn't particularly appreciate it.
Well, it's hard for anybody to take criticism and not forget the critic, and forget the critic. Although I was speaking for the faculty.
Hmm. How did it affect you?
Oh, I can't put my finger on it. For the remainder of my tenure, salary increases were meager. Now, whether that has anything to do, I don't know. Mm. It may have been completely unrelated. It may have been simply a recognition of my own lack of merit. I'm not making a point of it.
Mm-hmm. Can you say, he couldn't make decisions? This would be
he hated to make
on
decisions.
What kinds of things?
Anything. His way of making a decision was to put off and make no decisions, sort of feeling that if I don't do anything, the problem will go away. Well, often, as you know, no decision is a decision by itself. If you decide not to do something or you don't do anything, that's a decision. And the faculty were feeling restive because there were changes in curriculum and many, many kinds of changes that they wanted more leadership from the dean's office on. So.
What about appointments? Appointments to the faculty, did he have trouble making those?
No, I don't think so. Of course, there were always, he had an associate and an assistant dean who worked with him in his office, and they probably must have played an active part in that. Personally, I think we made some rather poor appointments, but that's merely a personal reaction.
There's a letter in the files from somebody, economic department, I can't remember his name, who said that he had, Fleming had asked him why he didn't, apparently he had something to do with the business school, and it was in the Social Systems Research Institute.
Mm-hmm. He was Robin is in the faculty, as I remember, had some sort of cross appointment that involved economics and business. Yeah. And what else I don't know.
Well, this man was part of the SSRI, and he said he had suggested five very good people to Gomnitz in the past few years, and Gomnitz hadn't.
For what appointments?
In the business school.
I'm not surprised.
And nothing had been done about them, so he was discouraged about that.
Well, I don't know who this man was nor what the suggestions were. It really doesn't make any difference.
No. Charles Holt.
There were a few appointments made to faculty positions, and some of them I thought and still think were a relatively weak people.
Yeah, that's.
He's suggesting to Holt that you offer cooperation in a staff improvement approach to the business school rather than concentrating at this time on the question of administrative leadership, which is the thing that I have been speaking to.
Mm-hmm. And this was Holt's reply.
They've been pretty discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
The business field is undergoing a revolution, and our school of business is moving at evolutionary speed. Perhaps that's the best we can do. I don't know, that's a pretty strong statement, but it does recognize the changes were occurring, which the faculty was aware of and wanted to relate to. Well, so be it.
Yeah.
I mean, that points up what I've been saying. Mine was the internal effort in the school at the request of the faculty to try to bell the cat.
Do you remember when you did this? Was it
no.
when Fleming
it
was
It would have
still?
Been in that period.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not particularly.
Apparently the school was continuing to emphasize the accounting and the... and should have been branching out much more. This is in this memorandum from Fleming to the files about his conversation with Gomnitz. He said, I had substantial criticisms of his deanship, both externally and internally, and goes on. I told him this criticism related very largely to a feeling that the school was still heavily oriented toward accounting and did not sufficiently take into account the quantitative methods and the behavioral sciences in the way in which a modern business school ought to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it is... Mm-hmm. Yes. In the next paragraph, externally and internally, I said much of the criticism was directed at the inability of faculty people to talk with him because he tended to divert the conversation to other subjects and because they felt there was insufficient participation by the faculty in the affairs of the school.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
mm-hmm.
what I was talking to. He's in effect suggesting to her that he resigns the end of next year.
Mm. But he didn't, did he?
No. Behavioral sciences, well, they made one appointment. It was a very weak one, again, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They were more nearly valid, although as he perceived it, the faculty was not very willing to take a stronger role in the leadership of the school. He left me with me a list of committees and indicated that the executive committee, in fact, felt it ought to go out of existence. Well, the faculty was saying there's no leadership from the top, and when we meet with the dean individually or collectively, nothing happens. So that each is criticizing the other on the same grounds.
Yeah. And you must have been on the executive committee as chairman of the department.
Probably, sure.
But felt that you couldn't do anything.
Silk purse out of a sow's ear. that kind of a problem. Well, I don't think we should beat this subject.
Well, I'm just curious as to whether the evaluation happened. I don't see any sign of it in the files.
I doubt
whether it did?
Not to my knowledge. You mean of the dean personally?
Outsider, they talked about several people, Art Weimer or James Kane. But.
Well, on the record, Irv continued as dean, I think, until June of 72. Mm-hmm. So that's 4 or 5 years. So whatever happened didn't change that.
No.
Didn't have much result. Didn't change the fact that he continued as dean for another 4 or 5 years.
In fact, I've understood that the ruling about the retirement of administrators was partly put into effect in order to get rid of Gomnitz and also of the law school dean at the time.
George Young.
Hmm. That it had something to do with the benefits you got if you stayed past 65.
Well, very likely the case. You need a couple of pressure points to bring about a change like that. Mm-hmm. And those were apparently viewed as two pressure points. George Young was a very dear friend. I know him very well. Everyone liked the man. Unhappily, unfortunately, he had a problem with the bottle. Mm. It was as simple as that. And I suppose that there was some chafing in the law school faculty. Again, because of a lack of leadership on his part.
Oh, yes.
Probably the record would show that.
Oh, yes, very.
Lawyers tend to be more outspoken than I think other groups. Mm-hmm. So that's your, it fits together.
Yeah. Well,
but I remember that I had told Dean Gomnitz that I was going to retire at the end of the 72 year. And it also, that was also somewhere along the way, whether before or after, I don't know, was it, I think, the date when he chose to retire. And there was a question raised as to my staying on. And I remember telling Irv, I don't know, I wondered afterward how he took it or how it sounded to him. I said, Irv, I don't want to stay on for another year or two and help break in a new dean. Well, Bob Bach was brought up as successor.
And how did he work out?
Well, he lasted 3 or 4 years and was resigned voluntarily, I guess you'd say. Didn't work too well. Mm. And why, I don't know, because I was out of the faculty and out of the school. But again, it was not an appointment, unfortunately, which worked out well.
This is tape 3 of the interview with Charles Center. Well, how about describing the events of October heavens, was it the 20th? Is the 18th, wasn't it? October 18th, 1967. You said you were
the Vietnam riot on campus
in the Commerce Building. Yes.
Well, I'll remember this very well. It happened to be a Wednesday, I know, because I was downtown at a meeting of our downtown Rotary Club. And, of course, everyone knew that there was the pot was boiling over on campus. At the meeting, I met with Walter Rank, who was a personal friend, and also a regent at that time. So he said, as nearly as I can recall, "Charlie, I suppose as a regent I ought to go out to campus and see what's going on." And I said something like, "Yes, I think it's probably your duty to do so. Come on, get in my car and go out with me." So we did that. It was 1:30-ish. I parked in a big lot then below Liz Waters on the lake shore. We walked up together, separated. He to go on to Bascom Hall to the president's office, and I went into the downhill front door of the comm school. And I got up on the main floor, up a short flight of steps, and there were the corridor was jam-packed with students sitting on the floor, all of them facing away from...
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Laundry day. All of them facing the other main entrance, or seated with their backs toward me. Well, I began very slowly to try to pick my way through. It was almost impossible. And one of the university officers was standing in the doorway of the classroom there, and he took my arm or motioned to me to come over, and he said, "You'd better not try to go any further." So he pulled me into that classroom doorway with him, where we observed. And it was only a short time later that there were loudspeaker bullhorn announcements to the group to advising them to leave and so on, violation of this rule and regulation and whatever. And there was a great deal of chattering. Nervous chattering, as I would, in the group. What's going to happen next, you know? Here we are, and we're not obeying these orders, these requests. And a large number of that group were female students. I suppose a third to a half, I had a guess. So it was only a very short time after that police came in and began to remove them. Now, I could see in the far end of the corridor, they were taking them up toward the main exit, and that we have a stairway in the building there, and I could see on that stairway also observing Professor Howard Westing of our faculty and Beck, of mathematics, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he's still in the faculty, to the best of my knowledge. Now, who else, I can't say. But when the police came in and began bodily to pull them out, I think what the students, at least the more or less innocent idealistic participants had viewed as high larks, high jinks, all of a sudden took a serious turn, and they began. And there was a good bit of screaming. I'd being bodily evicted, dragged if they refused to get up and walk. If they would get up and walk, the police would take them. An officer would take them by the arm and simply walk them out. But if they resisted, then they were just simply dragged out. Now, there are two interpretations then as to whether this consisted of police violence. One was Professor Beck's. The other was Professor Westing's and mine. Mrs. Smale, my
yes,
wife,
I think
Mary.
We met the other day,
did.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you.
I didn't see anything, nor did Howard Westing see anything that we personally thought was what you'd call police violence. We didn't see students being beaten or kicked or hurt. Professor Beck said he did, or he thought he did. I know that Howard Westing and I are of a different social and political, have a different social and political outlook than Professor Beck. If you want to use the old tried and true divisions, we would mm-hmm. be conservative and he would be liberal.
Mm-hmm.
So that he saw, what he said, one thing, we saw another. I did see the kid on the roof of Bascom, that famous notorious picture, you know, pulling down the American flag.
Mm-hmm.
It was published in the newspaper. After the students were all removed, I had a class at that point. This would have been between 1 and 1:30, because I think my class was a 1:30 or whatever that afternoon class hour is. It was a little seminar group. And I tried to put the whole thing out of mind, and the students, of course, the dozen or 15 kids in the class tried to put it out of mind, but it was hopeless for us to try to do anything in connection with coursework. We tried, but we finally agreed to give up. Oh, I do remember that one of the students in the group, I couldn't tell you his name at all today, was very indignant. If you would call me on my attitudes a conservative, then he was way off somewhere to the right of me at that point, because he was simply saying, they're interfering with my right to get an education. They're blocking the building. They're not letting me go to class, and they're creating all this furor. Well, I thought that was entertaining, at least, that a student should offer that point of view. A bit later in the afternoon, it couldn't have been very much later, because now all of the furor was out in the street and outside the building. I'll never forget this scene. One of the senior officers of the city police department, I knew his name at the time. He's since retired, an Italian name, and he was a career police officer. Was standing at the front entrance outside the building, standing stiff as a ramrod at attention, and students around spitting all over him. Well, it made my blood boil to see that. And the way that man took it without fighting, losing his composure. Well, I don't know that there's very much more to the story. Hearsay now that organizers of those kinds of protests are always wise enough to take their position in the back, so that when the eruption occurs, they can slide out the back door. And if that happened here, I say they certainly planned it well, because there was a back door I'd come in. You know that they leave all these naive, idealistic youngsters there to take the eviction while they were slipping out easily and comfortably. That may be or not be true hearsay. But there are only two incidents that followed. One was a faculty meeting, which in itself was in an uproar. because of the, we were all affected naturally, as emotionally and upset as the students. I went with Howard Westing, and as I recall, Anatole Beck spoke up, police brutality, that sort of thing. I nudged Howard. He had his nerves under much better control than I did mine, really. I was in no shape to...
You were very upset, were you?
I was in a very, very upset. But I knew we couldn't let Professor Beck go unanswered. So I nudged Howard and said, will you respond, because I can't. And he did. Then there was, of course, a trial. I don't remember now the charges. There were only two or three, four students brought into court. It was probably some relatively minor civil charges, disturbing the peace or whatever. And the district attorney, the judge, I can't think of his name, I know him, I could look up his name because he's a member of the Downtown Rotary Club, and I could look at that and tell you who he is. Still a judge. The district attorney's office asked me if I would testify as to what I had seen. I said yes. And they said, well, in that case, to protect you, we'd better subpoena you, so that you are not a volunteer witness, but you are being required. That may be some protection for you against any retaliation, strong resentments, and so forth, may or may not. Whether it did or not, I wouldn't know. I know that somewhere along in that period, there were eggs thrown at the front of the house, splattered all over the house.
Here?
Yes, here. And if you know what a dried egg, how hard it is to get rid of that, practically impossible. You can paint over it six times and it still shows. Well, that's not bad. I recall another part of the uproar and the emotional upset in the students' minds, as well as in mine and the faculty's. I had a son then, who was an undergraduate, my youngest son. He was terribly upset. I don't know what his feelings were, but I just know that he found that he simply couldn't work or concentrate. He eventually graduated from law school, but with a very, like a 3.49, so he managed somehow to recover. But another indication, perhaps, was that I had a teaching assistant then whose father was in the university administration. His parents lived here in the village. They were good personal friends. And this young man came to me, and in all seriousness, absolutely insisted that we could not give examinations, tests, and grade in any normal fashion that semester, because he says this to everybody in the class is so upset that it isn't fair. So his solution was to automatically give everybody in the class, some 200 students, A. I didn't do it. I said, we'll do our best anyway to make the course function as normally as possible and to grade as normally as possible. But he was very upset that I wouldn't agree that that was the proper thing to do. Well, of course, by and large, you have to say that there did occur about that time and afterward a lot of grade inflation.
Yes.
The records show that there were many in the faculty who sort of succumbed, shall we say, And on the average, I think probably there was an elevation of about one letter grade. It's pretty much across the board. Well, that's unfortunate.
Yes.
It means then in any evaluation thereafter, you just have to deflate correspondingly. That your B meant a C, actually. Well, so be it. That's about that story.
I don't know how you'd know. Whether the commerce students were particularly upset because it was in the building.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, and I thought you were going to ask, were commerce students also involved in this sit-in? Mm. I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I doubt very much. I don't think so. not as far as I know, is all I can say. Well, it was a very, very unhappy and unfortunate episode in our history. So best almost forgotten, I suppose, today. At least we did quit Vietnam. And I suppose that this sort of opposition, revolutionary thought on the part of young people across the country, and was perhaps as big a reason as any for doing so, for bringing that about. At least it was one of the reasons, whether the principal one or not. Who can say? Mm.
Were your students at all involved in the TA strike?
Not to my knowledge, no. No. I always found it hard to understand why the TAs would want to unionize and strike and so on. And that was simply a reflection, I think, of the fact that we didn't have in the School of Business great staffs of teaching assistants, as you might have in elementary economics or a basic history course or English course. The result of I don't know how many teaching assistants there may have been in, say, the accounting department, but I never had more than two at a time, and that was probably a fairly representative of the others who had substantial lecture courses. In accounting, there were laboratory assistants, teaching assistants, laboratory, accounting lab. And simply because you had these small staffs, there was a good personal relationship always. I think that was part and parcel of the reason why our TAs never felt like blowing up the world. there was a closeness. There were usually your TAs were your advanced graduate students working on PhDs. You were working with them. You knew them personally. You knew their families. They knew you. There would be guests in your home. They knew they were being treated fairly. They knew that faculty didn't set the salary scales, that those came from up on high. So that it may be that that's why I think in our school the TA strike drew no sympathy from our teaching assistants. They saw no need for it. You earlier mentioned the Keekhofer Teaching Award.
Mm-hmm.
And this little comment on our teaching assistants in the School of Business brings to my mind the fact that I did for 1 year serve on Kiekhofer's staff as a teaching assistant. And I have someplace a very effusive testimonial which Professor Kiekhofer drafted, and it was a staff of, well, we had 15 or 18 TAs, you know, that enormous old Econ 1A, 1B course. There was 1,000 or more students in it. This was a testimonial to my honesty, integrity, et cetera, because I ran the football pool in the staff. Well, then later on, and I have a mental picture, a vivid picture in mind of seeing Professor Kiekhofer. I was on his staff only the 1 year, on campus walking, obviously with great pain. He died of, I think it was prostate cancer, at least it was a cancer. Mm. I spoke to him. But he was obvious. He was not far from the death, and he was obviously coming into Sterling Hall, but in considerable pain. But then the Kiekhofer Award. I don't know why in particular. This was after World War II.
Yes.
When that was established by funds from his estate, as I remember. So I found myself on the committee to make the selection. I think we worked out a little procedure whereby departments and schools could make nominations to this committee with a selection to be made by the committee. And there was only one award a year. I understand since then there are a number of other grants that do the same kind of thing, but that at least to outstanding young teachers. I can remember that our first choice, the first year, this was Mike Petrovich. You know of him.
Oh, yes.
You know him personally?
Yeah, well, he's, yes.
All right. Well, Mike's a good friend today. It's again a friendship which has come about because we're both members of the Downtown Rotary Club. I was president of the club many years ago, and he served as president perhaps 10 years ago. So there's been a little kidding and bantering back and forth between us. We've gotten to know each other well, and I've kidded him about, look, I helped you get that first $1,000. How about a little loan back? This kind of talk.
Yeah.
Well, that's the Kiekhofer Award.
Yeah.
And the makeup of that committee was, I don't know whether I served on it the following year or not. There's probably a fair amount of turnover in it. I don't recall who the second recipient may have been, so I guess I wasn't on the committee. I think we've touched bases on now on it with everything you've mentioned.
Yes, all right. Would you like to talk about then the UW Faculty Association?
Yes. And as I say, I think this is my greatest contribution to the University of Wisconsin system. And it took as much of my time and thought and effort as teaching did almost, but only on occasion, not in between times. Back in the late 38-39, there was the death in the Letters and Science College of a young member of the faculty who left a family destitute. A collection was taken up for his family. But it was recognized that there must be created some way of meeting that sort of need for funds at a premature death of a faculty member. So a committee was appointed, and I hear Baird Taylor was the chairman.
Yeah.
And he was my major professor, and I was officing with him in one of those little Sterling Hall cubicles. And it was because we were so close physically, time-wise, that I knew much of what was going on in this committee, mm-hmm. even though I had nothing to do with it except to visit with Baird Taylor. The other members of the committee... It's in the document.
Yeah.
But there are some very notable members' names.
Yes, it was quite a...
top people.
Mm-hmm.
So that decided the committee... made this report of the special committee April 1939. And the faculty regular meeting of Monday, March 6, approved the following recommendations: that the faculty accept in principle a proposal for group insurance for the faculty, that the president be requested to appoint a committee to arrange for a suitable contract of insurance to be reported, and that the present committee be discharged. And then in according to the recommendation, that to the new committee presents articles of incorporation, University of Wisconsin Faculty Employees Benefit Association, outline of proposed contract of insurance below, and recommendations to the Board of Regents. So this was to be a group term life insurance contract. Well, the proposal made eminent sense. Normally, in any group life contract, an employer shares with the insured employees the costs of the insurance. In this instance, the regents, in effect, said, look, we're all for it, but we have no money to put in. Whatever you do, you've got to do yourself. you have to pay for it, faculty. So this one was in itself a real innovation in the field of group life insurance. There had never been a plan in which the insureds paid for the whole thing without employer contribution. And it was difficult to find a company which was willing to do something so innovative and untested. But finally what was worked out was a plan of insurance which covered from age 20 and I see it's up to age 64, but I think in fact from memory it was the cutoff age finally was age 50, that no one above the age 50 received any insurance. The logic being that retirement benefits were accumulating so that they would be available as a death benefit. Well, the amounts, the original premium was to be $12 a year. The amounts of insurance were almost minuscule. $2,430 at age 20, down to $760 at age 50, and thereafter nothing.
Mm. I'm going to turn the tape.
Well, one recommendation which the regents approved, and without which this entire insurance plan would fail utterly and completely and quickly, was that participation in the plan shall be a condition of employment for new employees of the university in the defined eligible group. The defined eligible group consisted of faculty, assistant professor rank on up, and a large part of the administrative staff, but not civil service, secretarial, etc. however those groups were defined. And initially, to get the plan off the ground, it had to be voluntary on the part of those, and a voluntary acceptance on the part of all of the eligible, every member of the eligible defined in that defined group. But then this provision took over that as to the future, all new employees are members as a condition of employment.
Who got that into it? Do you know?
Well, it was evidently the committee who planned it were wise enough to see that you could not politically club everybody in the faculty to go into it at once. It had to be voluntary to start with.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody says, no, I'd rather have the $12 a year than the insurance, that's their decision. But that looking ahead, there had to be a continuous inflow into the insured group of all employees for the simple reason that it would be extremely impracticable for every incoming employee to be exposed to what amounted to a persuasion sales talk, if you will, as to why he or she should join the faculty insurance program. It was just became a condition of employment, so that there was then an automatic inflow of members who would in time, they would replace all of those who went out either by reason of age, 50 on, or by reason of death, or resignation, so forth. So that was a key provision without which the plan could not function.
And that was before you got involved in it?
I was never involved in that early planning stage. I was simply an intimate bystander, a listener, with Baird Taylor. And I can remember long conversations with Baird, conversations with Baird, because his special field was corporate finance. Mark Ingram, who was math, and it happened at about that time, I was beginning to be quite a student of insurance. So on that one very small, in that one very small area, perhaps, I know Baird used to pump me, group life insurance. Mm-hmm. What did I know? What could I? So, and it forced me to do some reading and studying too.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps I made some contribution without being aware. I'd like to think that anyway. This insurance plan got off the ground. Articles of incorporation of a non-profit corporation, the University of Wisconsin, whose function was only to administer it.
Mm.
So, it sounded like an all-encompassing name. The University of Wisconsin Faculty Association sounds great, but only one function. Here are the signatures and so on of all the...
Yeah.
Well, then came World War II. And, of course, the university as such went out of business. At the end of the war, came back as an assistant professor, probably Baird Taylor, I don't know, my memory says say, and I was going to teach several courses in insurance to start with. He said, you ought to get into this thing. I said, okay, well, what happens? He said, I'll take care of it. So, this is about fall of 47, spring of 47 semester. First thing I knew, there had been a nomination and an election. I found myself elected to the board, and the first meeting of the board, I found myself elected president of this nonprofit corporation.
Hmm.
a bunch of very good people on it, but I was the only one who knew any how to spell insurance or understood the workings of this, how it worked. And so time passed, and we had a contract at that time with a company in Kansas City, I think it was Businessmen's Assurance. The working relationship with them was most unsatisfactory, because it was easy to see from our side that the amounts of insurance were completely inadequate by that time. The BMA, Businessmen's Assurance Corporation, was charging us 10% of the premium and doing very little except taking the premium, investing it, crediting us with the 3 or 4% of interest, writing a check when a death occurred, and that was all. So that, and they, I tried by correspondence and finally by telegram to get some response down there to say, look, we're not happy with this plan, we're not happy with our insurance program, we're not happy with your 10% charge. And there was very little response. Finally, when it reached the stage that they learned that we were about to oust them and find a successor company, they did send an officer up to meet with us. But it had reached a point where I knew that we that relationship was gone too long, too far to be a good one, and that. So I had some good friends who were officers of the Wisconsin Association of Life Underwriters. And of course, being in the insurance teaching field, the several Wisconsin insurance associations always made it a point to invite me to their annual conventions, and that's, I didn't mind, you know, you go to the cheese room, you see friends, this kind of thing. So. At that point, I got in touch with a couple of people whom I knew who were running the officers of the WALU, Wisconsin Association of Life Underwriters. I said, look, you got a convention coming up, and could you let me have 5 or 10 minutes of time on your convention program? Sure. So they scheduled me. And really, all that I did, and I did it there because I knew that every life insurance company and every life insurance sales agent in the state of Wisconsin was going to become aware, more than if I'd bought full-page ads in the Milwaukee and Madison state journals. I simply announced that we, the faculty association, had this group life plan, and we were going to put it out for bids. We wished any company that wanted to offer, solicit the business, welcome. Well, of course, that's when...
good idea.
Well, that's when the Kansas City company sent its officer up to all of a sudden find out what they could do to placate us. I said, too late, fellas, too late. Well, I had an enormous lot of work as a consequence, because about a half a dozen companies, they wanted to study what we had. We had to provide the information, and I had to do it. They came in with proposals. There was a question of negotiating then. My own board necessarily pretty much had to rely on me. So I had to analyze all their various proposals, compare them, the pros and cons of this versus that one, and finally give our board, my board, a recommendation. So So that that particular semester, I probably spent more time working for the Faculty Association than I did teaching school. It was just one of those crisis points. But finally, after all this work, it was recommended to our board that we accept the proposal of the National Guardian Life Insurance Company, which, you know, is headquarters here in Madison, down right by the big building there by the Edgewater.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Hmm. I actually didn't realize it was in Madison. That's interesting.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I know the building, but I never put it together with the insurance plan.
Well, I had a meeting with their two top officers, two meetings with them while we worked this thing over. Then I invited them to come to speak to a meeting of our board, present their proposal. We hashed it over, and they agreed to agree. In the first instance, well, there are many advantages to us, and the relationship has been so satisfactory that that still exists. Instead of 10% of premium, I'm speaking from memory, they agreed to handle it all for 3%. Which I might add, in later years, was negotiated down to the present 1%, which is peanuts, absolute peanuts, considering that they have all the work, all the record keeping, on an interest, we transferred then from the BMA, the reserve, which had accumulated to our credit, to National Guardian. Now this here again was one of the reasons that I saw as perhaps the strongest for having to greatly increase our program of insurance benefits, increase the schedule, the amount of death benefits, simply because over the years, from the time I first looked, from its inception in 1939, to 19, when we switched to National Guardian, September 1962, at about, take a figure of $100 because it's easy to work with. For every $100 of premium that the faculty was paying to the insurance company, first off, they took 10%, their charge. They paid the death claims, which accrued during the policy year. And at the end of the year, on average, over that period of years, you had $100 diminishing to $90. You had about $30 being paid out in death claims. Mm-hmm. That leaves $60. The $60 was added to our reserve, so that in effect we had an insurance plan which is only paying benefits of about less than one-third to our faculty people, and two-thirds was going into a savings account, which was a perversion of purpose. Mm-hmm. We were existing to pay death benefits. Do I make this
clear? Yes, indeed. Very.
So I was most unhappy about that. When we moved over to National Guardian, the grand sum of $139,490.15 was transferred. This was this accumulated reserve that had happened over all the years. That reserve has grown now, and you might wonder if we still aren't making the same mistake as of September 86, to a little less than $2.5 million. Hmm. Now, several great improvements. One, instead of a 10% charge, it was a 3%, and now a 1%. administrative cost against this. Secondly, we immediately began to negotiate with the actuaries and the officers of the National Guardian Life to build up, to increase the death benefit schedule, so instead of spending one and saving two, we'd get the two pretty close to an equilibrium. We wanted to pay out everything mm-hmm. in death benefits. Mm-hmm. Now, you can't say, some years you may have a lot of deaths and other years you have few, so you've got it's a seat of the pants kind of a judgment. Mm-hmm. But we did over 6 or 8 years make some very major increases in the amount of insurance up to where we had them in an approximate equilibrium, and in fact in the last year in the last policy year we suffered quite a deficit. Well, that might be alarming. If it goes on for a year or two, it will be alarming. But hold back. Sit.
Hi.
Yeah, at least they're here. Can you put them? Kennel.
Here, Doggy.
A big increase in the amount of death claims paid. A big increase in the amount received by the Faculty Association credited to our account with National Guardian, because instead of the 3 or 4% dividend which we had been receiving from BMA, National Guardian put it on a participating basis. This is a mutual company, so that the dividend has run as high as 10% in some years. I think now it's 8 or 8.5%. So that we had not only premium income, but we had that percentage on this amount as a plus against the costs of all the death claims which came in. Now there are two other major developments, happily, which didn't come at the same time. One was the original program and defined group with male only.
Oh yes, I noticed that.
Well, it's no longer true. But in the first instance, and here the Faculty Association board was ahead of the times considerably, because we said, why men only? Why not women? As a matter of fact, we wanted the women in because it would enlarge the total group and therefore strengthen the insurance fundamentals. And I can well remember one year we made a major effort. We set up several public meetings, female, women employees, faculty, etc., talk about this, and invite and get reactions, responses. We didn't get the first base. They weren't interested. They didn't want it.
That's extraordinary. Even the single women, like Helen White.
Look, I didn't find one encouraging response from one individual, and I went to speak to two or three such meetings. All they were interested in was retirement money. We want to build up our retirement account. And this is $12 a year, which subsequently was increased to $24. And that's a term insurance. You mean we're not getting any of that back? No, not unless you die. Mm-hmm. We don't want it.
Oh, I see. Yes, I see. Because they didn't have dependents, presumably. So
many of them didn't, and they saw no reason.
Uh-huh.
Well, that changed. That was our first effort. It was very discouraging. But but we came back again some half a dozen years later, and this time we found that somehow or other there had been a tidal change in the opinions of most of many women, many who wanted it then. Maybe there were more married women or women with dependents of the faculty in that time period. I don't know. But at any rate, so we changed our definition, to any person from male only. Mm-hmm. And in the initial instance, it was again on a voluntary basis. Any woman, member of the faculty who didn't want it, didn't have to take it. Voluntary, just like in the original plan when it was first set up. But thereafter, as to future new employees, it was a condition of employment without regard to sex. So the ladies who wanted it got it, and those who didn't want it didn't have to take it. Mm-hmm. And we had a satisfactory solution. So that's that was one change, which was something of a landmark change, I suppose. A more troublesome one came about with the integration of the two university systems into the one. Well, we had, when you remember, it was the University of Milwaukee, which was first integrated with the University of Madison some years before the total system mm-hmm. integration. And we had, of course, then extended the insurance plan. They were automatically brought into it. We had little to do with it. Didn't cause us any problems, except in terms of the governance of the faculty association itself, because it had been a board which in turn elected a president, its president, and the vice president, and secretary treasurers, all from Madison campus mm-hmm. people. And now we had to try to broaden that to include Milwaukee. I don't remember, we probably should have had, we had a nine-man board, and we probably should have had two or three from Milwaukee, but somehow or other, we never got more than one, and they didn't. But from then on, we always had one person from Milwaukee faculty on the board. The first man was a professor of economics, I remember. Well, but then with the system integration, here again we could see that it was going to be essentially the same as the integration of Milwaukee and Madison. That we had two kinds of jobs we had to do, and there were, one of them was that in all the other schools, Oshkosh, La Crosse, Eau Claire, etc., which were coming in, that initially it would be on a voluntary basis. And so that there was a job of information, education, call it what you want, just as in the beginning with the women and with here, of letting people know what it is, so that they would, as many as possible, accept. If you ask why that was an important job, it's because of what we call in insurance, due to the principle of adverse selection. That if you got two people and you approach either one of them about buying life insurance, the one who's dying is going to grab it, and the one who feels healthy and well is going to say, no thanks, maybe some other day. So that when you have this voluntary system of entrance, you tend to get the bad, the poor risks, the high mortality yeah. risks. So that in order to get, and it takes a period of 5-6 years before you work out your insurance program and it works out from under the excess mortality claims that result from that adverse selection. So our job was to get as many voluntary sign-ups as possible to try and get as nearly a normal group as we could. And the second job we saw was that we really had to reorganize the board, the governance of this faculty association, in order to give representation to schools around the state, so that they didn't. Well, we were thinking about that, planning, had our plans all made before about 2 years before the regents finally said, "Go ahead, mm-hmm. and install the faculty association insurance program in all schools." But we anticipated and we're prepared for it. And I think we've done a very good job of that. I haven't had any active part in it because I've been out since then, but at least it was during my last years as association president that we planned for it and prepared for it. As a matter of fact, the current president of the board is a Whitewater man.
It must be pretty automatic by now. Presumably the problems have been solved and it's he wouldn't have much to do, or does he?
The thing can go along pretty routinely for 3, 4, 5, 6 years until some sort of problem comes up, and then there's work to be done. All the problems, I think, are all of the foreseeable problems are well behind us, largely because of the very remarkable cooperation. How long a tether am I on?
Yeah, fairly long.
All right. From the officers of National Guardian Life. They do staff work. They anticipate. Mm-hmm. So that the kind of work that I was having to do is being coming forward down there now.
Mm.
And if our board has something in the way of a change in the insurance program, which it wants, all it has to do is suggest to them, and their actuaries will work it out and come back, and that's it. Right now, there is an operation on an experimental basis, a program which may or may not endure very long, because again, in this effort, my successors learned that they weren't spending quite enough of the premium to paying it back in death benefits. So, and here was $100,000 or $200,000 a year in interest coming from the insurance company to our credit, mm-hmm. on the reserve which it managed for us. So it was decided to use that interest to buy additional insurance on an annual term basis. In other words, to simply put that interest not into the reserve, but in effect to add it to the premium.
Mm-hmm.
But that... Stop?
Yes. This is tape 4 of the interview with Charles Sendick. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, in effect, what's happening now, really, is that the amount of insurance at every age is being increased by, I think it's 25%, and being paid for by this interest income. Now, if we find out that we're now being too generous, and that our death benefit schedules are too high,
yeah,
then we'll have to cut back. And actually, last year the plan ran a deficit of about I've forgotten the figure, but it was a fairly substantial $100,000, in which or $200,000 excess of death claims over total income. Well, if that happens this year, if you get that 2 years in a row, you begin to wonder, you know, maybe we're paying out too much.
Yeah.
So, but then you have to adjust. But for all these many years, you see, we've never paid out enough, and it's always a case of bringing the one out, trying to bring up death benefits to where they'd be close to, but not quite exceed income.
Uh-huh.
That point has been reached. Well, as I say, I'm very proud of this whole thing because it's a program. This is for the policy year, which ended September 87, most recent annual statement.
So you have all the deaths listed there, yes, on the faculty.
Yes, yes. And it was death claims totaled $667,890. And when you are paying that much out, that begins to be significant, I see. So this is the kind of thing that for 35 years I was trying to work toward, to make the amounts of insurance big enough to be meaningful, to see that the faculty got back all that it paid in,
yeah,
in benefits paid to families of the deceased members. Mm-hmm. That's, as I say, this is my...
Yes, you're very proud of it.
Yeah. Well, it's my source of greatest satisfaction.
Yeah.
There are names here that I recognize, people, yes, I know. And if you go through them, you...
Yes.
So that's the story of the University Faculty Association, which just recently changed its name for the better. Because the Faculty Association, without any further comment, sounds as if, you know, it's a very big organization with all kinds of responsibilities and opportunities. When actually it's a little nonprofit, it's a nonprofit corporation responsible only for a life insurance program for faculty.
Yeah. So what is it called now?
Well, they got the word insurance or something into it. I'm not sure just
that
what
that seems
they...
sensible. It is, yeah, it is. It is puzzling.
It is. It is.
There was a faculty assembly, and it would be very easy to get those two mixed up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can well remember a letter that came in from a very, very irate woman on the faculty of maybe the Oshkosh or Superior, someplace up that way. When this was being broadened out to include all the state schools, and when at the same time the board of directors of the association had said that we wanted to modify the membership in the board of 9, not to enlarge it, but simply that three of the 9 should always be from outside other schools than Madison or Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. Well, we had arrived at that 3 out of 9, 33%, by a very careful study of the total membership which we might expect to have, Madison, Milwaukee on one side, all the other schools on the other.
Yeah.
And it looked as if the maximum number from the that might come in from the other schools could be up to about 1/3 of the total. We didn't really explain that, I guess. Maybe that was why we had trouble. But we said, in effect, that 3 directors, our bylaws would be changed, and that we were seeking ideas and suggestions as to how these 3 new directors could be nominated and chosen and elected and so forth. Well, we got the most irate letter back from this woman. Oh, she was mad. Just like Madison, you know, wants to run everything. She was completely ignorant of the whole thing and didn't know its history. It had been founded right here.
Yeah.
The 2/3 of the membership is here. I wrote her.
Was she placated?
I don't know. I wrote her a sweet little sugary letter. I didn't try to say what you... Never heard from
she
her.
She never wrote back and said, I'm sorry.
No, of course not. No. Well, that was just one of the little incidents.
That is interesting.
Made the work entertaining.
Yes.
Not pleasant, but... Well, I think probably we've pretty well covered this subject, unless you have questions.
No, that's very interesting. I think you presented it very well.
Well, I worked with a lot of very fine people on that Faculty Association board. But again, for better or for worse, the work was primarily personal on me, simply because, well, a professor of Spanish and Portuguese, or pharmacy. Mm-hmm. This is scarcely their field of expertise, and it was mine. So they simply had to rely on me, and that was a burden that I felt too.
Did you get any compensation for it?
No, of course not. Nobody got any. No one gets anything. This is a non-profit corp. No one is paid a nickel. The only thing that approaches compensation, this isn't compensation. This is when we expanded the board to include directors from other campuses. We said, look, it isn't fair to ask them to drive to Madison for a board meeting at their own expense. So now they put in expense accounts for the travel, the car expense.
Yeah.
And so I think those expenses amount to a couple hundred dollars a year or something on that sort, very modest. But again, nobody otherwise gets a nickel.
Do you have an office in which you do the work?
No.
You do it in your own office?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Huh.
It's a labor of love. It was. Galen Nula, now President Whitewater, very, very able man. I think his field is political sciences, president of the board. Galen's all I can think of, and I believe that's his given name. There are now women members of the board. That's quite a change, reflective of the times, mm-hmm. properly, I think.
Well,
think of anything?
I don't. Do you?
No.
Well, I think this is a good time to end then.
Not waste any more tape.
Well, thank you. It's been very interesting.